Okay, thanks very much. So I'm going to talk about the RNA world, and I'm going to start by giving quite a few background slides about what is the RNA world and why should we believe in it. And then I'm going to talk about what I actually do, which is computational models of replication, which represent how the RNA world might have worked and how things could have evolved in the RNA world. So we know that in modern organisms, we have DNA, RNA, and proteins. That's three informational kinds of polymer, and they all depend on each other, right? So that's very complicated. And the RNA world theory would say that there was only one kind of polymer originally, which was RNA. So the genes were made of RNA, and the replication was catalyzed by RNA. So that's really a definition of what RNA world is, that there were RNA genes whose replication was catalyzed by RNA. And it might not have exactly been RNA. People say, well, it could have been a slightly different backbone or slightly different bases on the chain or something. But the point is that it would have been a kind of nucleic acid polymer which worked by complementary base pairing. So I'm going to call it RNA. And ribozyme is the word for a catalytic RNA, okay, which we'll use a lot. So when was this? We actually know the age of the Earth very well from dating of things like rocks on Earth and meteorites. So meteorites are the oldest rocks that we know, in fact. And that gives us 4.5 billion years ago. So this time scale is in billion years ago. And we know the age of the Earth. And we also know that for some time after that, the Earth was settling down. There was large numbers of big meteorites, meteorite impacts, which would have been enough, in fact, to destroy anything that was on the Earth and maybe even vaporize the whole ocean. So people try to make a guess about when did those things settle down, when was the last ocean vaporizing impact, and maybe according to this picture it's 4.2 billion years ago. People argue about that we don't quite know, but there's some boundary round about here. And then coming from the other side, we know when is the earliest evidence for life? And it's around about 3.5 billion years ago for microfossil evidence. That means things in rocks that look a bit like cells. And people argue about whether they're really cells or whether they're something else that's not life. But even when you, there's a fair amount of controversy about which is the earliest one. But if you, my reading of that literature, well, it's maybe 3.5, maybe it's 3.2. The people who don't believe the 3.5 believe the 3.2. So that doesn't make very much difference. And some people would also say there's isotopic evidence. So around about 3.8 billion years ago is isotopic evidence. That means that you look at the ratio of carbon isotopes in rock and sulfur isotopes and things like that, and you deduce that those were formed by living things. So there's a window then where the interesting stuff happens, and that window may be as short as, say, 100 million years or up to half a billion years, but it's a short window compared to the length of the age of the Earth, right? So for most of the age of the Earth, we've had life on it. So why do we believe in the RNA world? The main reason is because proteins are made by RNA. So here's a cartoon of protein synthesis. We have our orange blob, which is the ribosome. Really looks like this. All the interesting bits of the ribosome are RNA. All this gray stuff is ribosomal RNA. We have tRNAs, which are decoding the genetic code, and we have the messenger RNA, the pink strand there. So the whole point of protein synthesis is to take information from RNA and make it into proteins. And that kind of says, well, we must have known how to make RNAs before we learned how to make proteins, at least by this mechanism. So interesting question is, what might amino acids and peptides have been doing in the RNA world? They were probably there, but they wouldn't have been encoded sequences, right? So as far as we know, the only way to make a specified sequence of a protein is to encode it in RNA in this case. So I kind of view that as fairly good evidence that the RNA must have come first. But then we also need some experimental evidence that the RNA could have carried out replication. So
is it absolutely, how sure are you that the only way of making a polypeptide, you know, that there wasn't some inorganic possibility of polypeptides?
Well,
because I want to know, I mean, one theory is it could have been a sequestration system for these nasty amino acids.
So there's a difference between making random peptides and making a specified sequence, right?
But random peptides could have.
So random peptides, maybe you can make random peptides in other ways. But if we're thinking of something like a gene with a specific sequence, as far as we know, we can't go from a protein sequence directly to another protein sequence, right? Whereas with a nucleic acid, you can. Okay?
No, I'm just saying that the one hypothesis of why make proteins is because random polypeptides are toxic.
Well, that's no good for origin of life. I mean, the argument for origin of life, if peptides are going to be something to do with origin of life, what you have to say is that random peptides are useful for something. And there are people who argue for that, in fact. There are people who argue, that's what I thought you were going to say.
No, that's not where I'm coming from. So I'm coming from the idea that random peptides form amyloid, which is toxic.
Right.
So it could have evolved as a sequestration system. Because if you make non-random peptides...
Toxic to what, though? It's only toxic when you've got something living already.
Yeah.
So if you've...
I'm not talking about the origin of life, I'm talking about the origin of proteins.
Okay. I'm talking about the origin of life.
Okay.
And I want to know... One important question is whether nucleic acids came before proteins. And I'm arguing
I'm
arguing that they do. They do. And the main reason is because... we don't know how to make another protein from a protein. And I think it's very important that no cell has learned to do that, right? If we believe the RNA word for the moment, if we believe that the genetic code came later, and now all these organisms have got this huge repertoire of proteins, which do more or less every function in the cell, what they don't do is make proteins, right? If proteins could learn to make proteins by themselves, you could get rid of DNA altogether, right? And the fact that no organism has done that is, to me, seems another argument in favor of RNA world.
I'm just saying, I believe in an RNA world. I thought it was uncontroversial.
Okay. That's right.
I was sort of going to ask that same question, whether either now or maybe at the end, if hopefully there's time. Can you just give me some perspective on, like, people who don't believe in the RNA world, like what are the alternative hypotheses,
people talk about lipid worlds, for example, where you.
I'm just trying to get a bigger perspective.
Yeah.
People who don't.
Yeah. So people.
This is the way things work. What are the alternate hypotheses?
So people talk about lipid worlds, which is where you're supposed to have some aggregate of, let's call them lipids, or any molecules that assemble into a structure. Like a micelle or something, right? And that has compositional information. And if something like that can grow and divide, it might pass on the information in the composition. So it's like a mixture of molecules. But that's rather limited information. It doesn't have sequence information. And sooner or later, we need to make sequence information because that's how biology works with genes. So I thought about that for a while and decided, well, it doesn't get you where you want to go. And then some people talk about proteins first, but I don't really believe that because I don't know how you make a protein from a protein. That's what I was saying. And then there are all sorts of variations on which kind of polymer, which kind of nucleic acid analog could have been first. And those are sort of variations on a theme. So some people will say, well, the RNA backbone is a bit unstable. We need something more stable than that. And there are people who have constructed nucleic acid analogs with different backbones. But there's not really a good argument to me as to why one specific alternative is better than RNA, I don't think. So, yeah.
One small comment on terminology, just being from the Midwest with lots of religious crazy people and being at a institution that is actually religious in its nature, believe in is if we could use evidence for, because the nuts say that we believe in this the same way they believe in whatever, and just something for us to be thinking about as we go.
I will have an interesting conversation with you about believe later.
Okay.
Because I'm actually...
Okay.
What do I mean by... Okay, what do I mean by believe? I mean that this is our best guess at what happens, right? This is...
Yes.
But we don't...
There's evidence for it, right?
There's evidence for it, exactly, yeah. Right, so part of the evidence then is what do ribozymes do in the lab? So this is a ligase. So this strand here is one strand, which is a ligase. And there's two strands on the top, which I'm calling A and B, and there's a reaction going on here, which is joining the end of the A to the B. So the reaction is A plus B makes another strand, which we'll call E, and then the E prime strand is the bottom strand, which is complementary to the E. And the nice thing then is that the opposite reaction happens, that the A prime and B prime join together to make the E prime, and that's catalyzed by the E. So each strand catalyzes the formation of its complementary strand from two subunits, right? So that works in the lab, and that is autocatalytic. So so what it means is that the E and the E prime together make more of themselves, and they require you to put in the A's and B's, okay? So given the A's and B's are present, the E and the E prime make more of themselves. So that's an autocatalytic cycle, which is a key element for what life is about, but it's not sufficient for origin of life, because it doesn't say where the A's and B's came from. So in this case, the A's and B's are fairly, you know, they're fairly long sequences, and they are specific sequences. So we don't know how random chemistry could make specific sequences. Yes.
So what you're saying is that you just have the pairing, and that's enough to link them. I'm sorry, I just don't really understand.
These things come together because they're pairing with the opposite strand, and there's something very specific about the 3D conformation of that, which I guess we don't really know, which makes that reaction happen to join them up.
Is the catalysis so necessary for A and B to form E? Without E, will A and B form E?
Well, I presume that reaction can happen, but it'll be so slow that you'll never see it, right?
So how do you ever get E?
They do in vitro selection, right? So all these drivers I'm going to talk about is in vitro selection from a pool of random sequences.
So maybe I can make a quick comment. The ribozyme does stabilize the transition state of this reaction and makes it go orders of magnitude faster than if you just brought those same things together without the three-dimensional structure of this particular ribozyme.
But if the reaction is not sitting with E,
nothing back. How do you get the ribozyme in the first place if you need the ribozyme to make the ribozyme?
This is a model.
This is an experiment, and they have selected for sequences which do this, right? And so what I'm saying is this demonstrates one aspect of what we want for life, but it doesn't demonstrate origin of life, because it doesn't tell us where the A's and B's came from. That's one thing, right? So, okay. So another example which is very similar is Niles's work on recombinases. So this thing here is a recombinase. It has four strands of different colors, and the function of this thing is actually to make a loop here between the two ends. So these ends get joined together and we make a loop. And when we've made a loop on all of those, there's three places where we make a loop, then we have one long strand. And that's what this part says. This thing with the dots in represents one long strand of the four pieces all joined together. And these are autocatalytic reactions that assemble from the pieces to make one long strand. So that's another example of RNA supporting autocatalytic cycles. Now, the kind of ribozyme I'm most interested in is a polymerase. And a polymerase is going to make a new strand from monomers. And it's using a template strand to tell it which sequence to make. So the cartoon is, the red blob is a ribozyme that's folded into a structure. It binds to a template strand, which is red here. And it's assembling the complementary strand from monomers, okay? And this is what it looks like. So this is the one from the picture of the Johnson paper. So the outer part here is the ribozyme, which has a particular sequence and a particular structure. And then the template strand is the red one, and the new strand is the yellow one. And these are just X's, because ideally they could be any sequence, right? So what we would like is a ribozyme which binds to any template strand and makes the complementary strand independently of the sequence, ideally. So in that paper, it would only go up to 14 nucleotides, and that's been getting better gradually by improving of this thing in the lab. So these papers improve on that picture by adding bits and by further in vitro evolution, and they're claiming up to 200 nucleotides now, which is as long as the ribozyme itself. So if you could copy a sequence which is as long as itself accurately so that there was no errors, and fast enough so that it was not, that strand was not broken down before you copied it, then that would be supporting life, right? And it would be working from monomers. So I'm prepared to assume that chemistry gives us monomers, but I'm not prepared to assume that chemistry gives us huge long sequences, right? So I'm saying we're getting there, right? This one is not autocatalytic yet, but it works from monomers. The other ones are autocatalytic, but they work from long strands. So the question then is, how do we get something like that started? And there must be chemistry before biology, okay? So the chemical environment that was going on must be such that you could make nucleotides and make random RNA polymers. And within that mixture of random polymers that was being made by chemistry, something useful, a functional catalyst emerges, okay? So we have to be able to show experimentally that chemistry can give us both monomers and polymers. So there's quite a lot of work on prebiotic synthesis of nucleotides, and this paper by Powner is a fairly famous recent one, which found a new route to synthesis of a nucleotide. And the point of that was the most obvious way of synthesizing a nucleotide is to make a ribose and then make a base and then join them together. And people have been trying to do that for a long time. And that is the blue route here. And there's an X there which is saying that this joining of a ribose to a nucleotide to a base didn't work very well, and the chemistry of that wasn't really working. And they found some sort of a side route by the green arrows which allows you to form a nucleotide here without ever having to do that reaction. And so it seems that people are making progress on synthesis of single nucleotides. Still not really sure how that happened on Earth and where on Earth, what were the conditions where that happened, a bit vague.
Is the chemistry here solid state chemistry or is it in water?
Don't know.
It's aqueous phase.
Yeah. Well, so according to what you believe the world was like, you can claim your synthesis mechanism is prebiotic, right? Because we don't really know what the mixture of starting materials was. So, but let's assume then, I'm prepared to say that chemistry is going to give us nucleotides, and then chemistry have to give us random polymers. So, famous piece of work on synthesizing RNA polymers is by Ferris's group, and they showed that montmorillonite clay catalyzes the formation of fairly long oligomers of RNAs, 30 or 50. And more recently, people have done this with showing that lipids help in the synthesis of RNAs. So in these papers, what they do is they have RNA monomers in a mixture of lipids, and they dry the thing down, and the lipids form lamellar phases, and the monomers get sandwiched in between. So in fact, there's a picture here. So this is a picture which kind of goes with the experiments I was just talking about. The idea is, if you dry out lipids, they form these lamellar phases, and other stuff, like the RNA monomers, gets sandwiched in between. And they claim that polymerization happens in that kind of a lamellar phase. And what these guys, so this is Damon Dela from Santa Cruz, I just spent a day with them last week. They're interested in the idea that you have wetting and drying cycles. So in the dry phase, you're doing the sandwiching of the molecules, and that's a low water content, and low water content favors polymerization because the polymerization is removal over water, basically. The reaction is removal over water. But they also alternate between wetting and drying cycles. So in the wet phase, you get molecules trapped in little vesicles, and they move about and they exchange with one another. And so they argue the cycling between the wetting and the drying favors the increase in length of the polymers. So they're imagining this happening in freshwater volcanic pools. So they go and do experiments in Kamchatka and Yellowstone Park and places like that where you have these hot springs. So that's the environment they're imagining.
Where is Damer and Dreamer? Where do they work?
Santa Cruz.
So this is more than just a concentration? More than just changing the concentration of the RNAs?
Yes, because you want... So There are, so in water, the thing tends to hydrolyze, right? So it tends to break down if you just have it in solution. So you say, well, we want to find dry conditions, but if you just dry it out, the things stick and they don't move and they don't react. So their argument about why the lamellar phase works is because it's low water content, but it's still flexible, so the things can move about and find one another. And they have experiments, so the experiments are beginning to work on that kind of wetting and drying thing.
How might the addition of salt affect this process?
Don't know, but those guys claim it's important you have low salt. So those guys say it happens in freshwater pools. And one thing I was just going to say is these other guys say it happens in the sea. So these are the hydrothermal vent people. They say it's high temperature, high pressure, and high salt because it's in the sea. So I don't think we know is really the answer. I don't think we know where was the best location to form RNA polymers.
Did you say where the lipid came from in the previous example?
Lipids are presumed to have been there, simple lipids. So for the other thing that Deem is famous for is having isolated simple lipids from meteorites. So organic meteorites contain large numbers of carbonaceous meteorites contain large numbers of organic molecules of all kinds, basically, including amino acids, including some small amounts of nucleotides, including lipids. And the lipids that you get there they're not big phospholipids, two-tail things that we get in membranes now. They're simple lipids like fatty acids and things. So they've done a lot of work with decanoic acid, right, which forms membranes, much less well-established membranes than phospholipids, but it forms membranes and vesicles and things. So that's the kind of thing that they're imagining.
And then you get concentrations, right, sort of drying, repeated drying, wet periods or something.
What about prebiotic synthesis of pyro or polyphosphate bonds? So I know that was a problem for a while, just getting energetic sort of.
Isn't that what that's what we were just saying here, isn't it? How do we form sugar phosphate backbones? Is that what we're talking about?
No, how do you get the high energy polypyrophosphate?
So
which is generally what drives that.
Yes.
Those.
So these guys have the activated nucleotides, either a triphosphate or they use this other thing which is a imidazole or something,
right,
which is a high energy group on your nucleotide which drives the polymerization. And then these guys just use monophosphates. So one thing that's important about these things is they're monophosphates only.
So they fixed it by going around it rather than saying, yep, there's a way of getting this, you know.
Yes, to make an activated nucleotide might be hard. And so
Yeah.
So they're trying to show that you can get some small, slow polymerization rate without having to do the activation.
Okay, and then polyphosphate becomes sort of a later problem.
Yes.
Future life's problem.
Right, I don't know whether that's right or not. Okay, so where am I then on all this? I guess I'm saying I have to believe that the chemistry happens. So what I want to say is that there's fairly good evidence that the chemistry can give us nucleotides and that chemistry can give us random polymers somewhere, somehow. And now we want to understand how something interesting emerges from the random polymers. And I just put this picture in, which is a sort of review that we did with Niles there, bringing together what are the questions that we need to understand to put a full picture of the RNA world together. So I already talked about prebiotic chemical synthesis, about finding functional ribozymes in sequence space. I'm going to talk now about evolutionary theory, how do ribozymes evolve? And that involves molecular cooperation. So the main message for today is that we have to think of this as an evolution of cooperation between different molecules. We need some energy in metabolism. So we need some source of chemical energy probably that's out of equilibrium. So it's like reducing gases coming from the bottom of the sea or in our hydrothermal pools or something. There needs to be some supply of things that keeps the thing out of equilibrium. Don't really know very much about the early Earth environment, whether it was freshwater, salt water, what was the temperature. And one thing I didn't say is that best ribozyme that does a sequence of length 200 works in ice at the moment. It works in little eutectic phases, which is high salt, cold water between ice crystals. So, and then my last question here is, we need cells at some point. I better say something about cells as this is cell biology. So I'd like to know, how did replication get associated with cells? Was it in fact that there were cells in the first place? So this kind of picture means that there were lipids all the time, and maybe the replication was going on inside these protocells, let's call them, or vesicles. Or maybe something was going on without, something was going on bound to a surface. So in the simulations I'm going to talk about, I don't have cells at all. I'm going to talk about molecules moving about, maybe bound to a catalytic mineral surface, interacting with their neighbors. And then at some point, that has to get enclosed in vesicles. So this picture is a kind of a timeline as well as a space thing. They're imagining the chemistry is going on in these little crevices in the rock. And eventually, lipids become involved, and the things kind of bud off from their mineral surface and become cells. So again, there's a lot of hand waving in all those things. So now we get to my work then. So I want to think of an evolutionary theory for the RNA world, and I'm going to say several things. So one thing is that if we have a chemical system to describe replication, then it has a living and a dead state. So a living state is where there are molecules which are catalysts, and they catalyze making more of those molecules. So that's autocatalysis. And the dead state is where we have random chemistry going on, and we don't have autocatalysis. And I'm supposing we start in that dead state, and we have to get to the living state. So, and that's the stochastic transition, which I'm going to talk about. And to get that to happen, it turns out to be important that we have spatial clustering of cooperating strands. So the spatial model is going to be important, like in the simulation I was showing before you came in. I want to look at cooperation at a slightly higher level as well. So I want to look at how ribozymes with different functions can cooperate together. Okay. And in particular, I'm going to talk about polymerases, which make polymers, and nucleotide synthetases, which make monomers for use by the polymerase. So that's two independent, unlinked things which have to cooperate together in order to make the whole system work. So that brings us on to thinking about levels of selection. So in this meeting, we've been thinking about levels of selection, about major evolutionary transitions, which is again a thing about how do you make the low-level things cooperate to form a higher-level thing. So we'll touch on that as well. So then the theory in the simplest terms says that we've got precursor molecules there on the Earth. The chemistry is giving us precursor molecules, and we have to make them into some kind of a catalyst. And that has to be able to happen by spontaneous chemistry to make the first one. So it must be possible to make a catalyst from the precursors, because otherwise we'd never get the first one, okay? And that spontaneous chemistry is probably a very slow and unsuccessful kind of a reaction, but once in a while it works, okay? Now once we've got an appreciable fraction of the catalysts, they can make themselves by an autocatalytic reaction. So the catalyst itself catalyzes the formation of more catalysts. So that's the autocatalytic part, which I'm calling biology. And once that's going, it's much faster than the chemistry. Okay? So systems of reaction systems that have that structure have two states. The dead state has a negligible concentration of the catalyst, and the reaction rates are controlled by the spontaneous chemistry. And then the living state has a high concentration of the catalyst, and the reactions are controlled by the catalyst. So we have to get from a dead state to a living state. And the first model that we did of that was a fairly explicit model of RNA polymerization. So we imagine we've got precursors which are formed into monomers, that's single nucleotides, and we've got activation of the nucleotides, and the activated nucleotides polymerize, and some of them become long enough to actually have be able to form structures that do things, and some tiny fraction of these long ones is actually a ribosome. And if the ribozyme is able to catalyze any of these steps, then it becomes autocatalytic, right? So to begin with, we're going around the outside of this diagram very, very slowly and inefficiently. We're waiting for millions of years until we get one or two of these. And once we get one or two of these, then these can catalyze any of these steps in principle, and the whole thing gets going.
So it's the assumption that the ribozyme would catalyze all of those steps, or are there, so if it, is it each step a rate limiting step?
It could have catalyzed any of those steps to speed things up. I'm gonna, in my first version of this, I'm gonna suppose it catalyzes the polymerization step. But we did a theory where it catalyzes nucleotide synthesis as well. So our first version was relatively complicated in the reaction. So we had precursors making a nucleotide, which is an A. Then we have an activation step makes an activated nucleotide, an A star. And an A star binds to a polymer of length N to make a polymer of length N plus 1. And all these things are lost to the outside. So that U, that is a disappearance of my polymers that I want. And it's either diffusion away from the region where it's happening. For example, if it's catalyzed on a mineral surface, they diffuse off into the sea and we never see them. Or it could be a hydrolysis, a breakdown of that thing. So anything which is destroying it is really in that U term.
Well, why do you need to have the synthesis step being catalyzed by the ribozymes?
But you don't have, so to begin with, you mean the first step?
Yeah, the first step. It seems like you could get around that, because if it's been made in the environment, all you need is to get access to it, either.
So I'm presuming, in fact, that the first step, that the environment contains the monomers to begin with, I'm presuming. Right?
Yeah.
And so probably the most important ribozyme is the polymerase, which catalyzes.
Absolutely.
So that's the way I'm thinking about it. But also, ribozymes that catalyze synthesis will also help you, because the whole thing's going to go faster. The concentration is going to be faster. So an interesting question is, which kind of ribozyme could emerge first? And there are some people who like monomer synthetases first.
It seems like that's something that's already existing. It's a resource in the environment.
So to begin with, it's a resource, but you're going to run out of it. So even a nucleotide is a pretty big molecule, and we hope. So life has to evolve in very permissive conditions, right? It has to be, you have to give things a lot before it can get started. But once it gets started, it learns to do things for itself that it used to have to be given to it, right? And so you're going to run out of nucleotides as soon as you get this replication going. So you're going to have to go back to simpler molecules which had higher concentrations and that didn't get used up. So you're going to have to start synthesizing nucleotides too. So the point of this model then is that we have a feedback between the formation of ribozymes and the polymerization rate. So the R at the bottom there is the rate of polymerization, and it has an R naught, which is the chemical part, and then a KPL, where PL is the concentration of long polymers. So if we get a large concentration of long polymers, which can be ribozymes, that increases the polymerization rate. So that's the autocatalytic part. And I just want to show you the...
Sorry. Can you just go back one slide? So, where do you think this... Is this happening in that same... vesicles or in those...
I don't know. For this...
It doesn't matter.
For this model, I don't need to say that, right? I mean, somebody somewhere needs to find the chemical environment where these reactions happen. But for the model, I don't need to say that, really. Okay. For the model, what do I need to assume? I need to assume that chemistry will give you the blue reactions at least at some non-zero rate, right? And then that the biology speeds them up. That's really the point. Yeah. So I wanted to show you the phase diagram of that. So we said there's a living state and a dead state. And we have an axis here, which I call the chemistry axis, which is the rate of the spontaneous polymerization. And then we have an axis, this is the biology axis, which is how good are the ribozymes when you form them, okay? So if biology is bad, that's just saying the sequences when you form them are still no good, they have a slow catalytic rate, then you're down the bottom of this diagram and you're dead only, right? So if biology doesn't work, then you're dead, right? If you're up here, that's where chemistry is good and biology is good, then you have a living state only. So that's like saying I throw any old chemistry together in a bucket and I come back and things are crawling out of it, right? So if you were only in a living state, that would mean life was spontaneously popping up very easily, right? So that doesn't make sense, right? So what makes sense is that we're in this part of the phase diagram where we have a dead and a living state. So right, so living things can be dead, that's fairly obvious, right? And what I mean by having two possible states in the same environment, I mean that for life to evolve, the planet has to be able to support life, right? So the chemical environment has to be able to support the existence of life. But if the planet can support life, it doesn't mean that life is automatically there. You have to be able to get there in the first place, right? Which is the hard step. So the two states exist in the same environment. Yeah.
Can you define for me what dead and living?
So dead. So what I mean, well, in terms of this reaction, I mean that in the dead state, this part is much larger than this part, right? This is some small non-zero rated polymerization. And if this concentration of catalyst is very low, this is even smaller than that. So what we get is few polymers and they're controlled by the chemistry. But if we get to a state with high concentration, then this part becomes higher than this part, and now this part doesn't matter anymore, right? So that's really the... So the red dotted line... The red dotted line on here is a boundary where the living, the autocatalytic reaction becomes faster than the spontaneous reaction. Okay. Now, if I go around this part of the, if I go around this roof here, there's only one state, and the concentration increases smoothly as I go around this state. And so these dotted lines are different definitions of what counts as dead and alive. When I only have one, I have to make a definition, right? Whereas here, there are two states. So if I go across this boundary, suddenly a second state appears, which is very much higher concentration. So this is very clear what I mean by these two boundaries, because inside there's two states that are stable, and outside there's only one.
Catalytic efficiency is a ratio of the catalyzed rate to the spontaneous rate.
It's the parameter. It's the parameter that's the K parameter in that case.
Okay, so it's the fraction of polymers that actually do something.
Yes. So it's a product of the fraction that do something times the rate at which they do something, right? Yeah.
So how did you arrive at this phase diagram? Is this a system of?
So well, I'm trying not to give you all the differential equations for that one. So
but
we
that's
have
what it is.
Yeah. So we have differential equations to control concentrations of polymers of different lengths, and we find the stable states of those things. And that was a fairly complicated model. And what we realized then is that this phase diagram was we think it's important, and we wanted to find the simplest possible model which has the same phase diagram. So I want to spend a little while on the simplest possible one equation version for origin of life. So we have some concentration of replicating molecules, which is phi, and the rate of increase of phi is some function of the current concentration, f of phi. And the f of phi is going to be a cubic equation there. And we have three terms which represent creation of the replicator. We have a spontaneous formation reaction, an S, and an S means monomers come together and form a random sequence. And then we have an R phi. So this is linear replication, which is a template-directed synthesis. So I have a strand, which is formed, and monomers are coming and forming a new strand, which is complementary to the first one. And the point then is that that's proportional to the existing concentration, because it's proportional to the strands that are already there. Okay? And then we have what we're really interested in, which is catalyzed replication, which is a K phi squared. So that's this picture, which is like the ribozyme I showed you a while back, where we have one strand, which is the blue circle, which is folded to a structure, which is doing the job. Then we have a template strand here, and then monomers are coming in and making the next strand. So that's two molecules make three. So that's a phi squared. Now, if we stop there, things would go up to infinity. We have to have something that limits them going to infinity, so we need some kind of a carrying capacity. And in this thing, one is the carrying capacity. So when it reaches one is the concentration where you can't go any farther because you've run out of space or you've run out of resources. And we need a turnover, so we need a destruction rate. So this minus phi is the rate of destruction of the molecules or the rate of diffusion of those molecules away from the region where it's happening, okay?
So that blue circle in the bottom right is in fact the same as the blue beads on a chain.
Yes. So in this molecule, in this model it is, because there's only one kind of thing. Later on, which I want to think about, this blue circle is the catalyst, and the template could be any other sequence which is copied by the catalyst, right?
And the assumption here is that the monomers are sufficient to do whatever chemistry and biology needs to be done.
You mean sufficient concentration or sufficient...
So the concentration of monomers isn't in the model.
Yes, in this, that's right, because they're all proportional to the concentration of monomers, I guess, that's what I'm saying.
It's lumped in with the S and the R and the K.
Yeah, I think that's the way to think about it.
Okay.
So, the phi here, phi is a destruction or escape rate, which means it's something per second. But in the, for instance, before that, it looks like it's a concentration.
There's a one constant here, which is one per unit time, isn't there? So I've got, there's two scales here. I need to set a scale of maximum concentration, which is this one,
okay. And
then I need to set a time scale, which is the minus one here, that's the life, so the minus one is the lifetime. So in fact, in all my models I do that, basically the lifetime of the molecule is one, and then that gives me a time scale on the S's and R's.
Okay.
And if there are errors in replication, it will be accounted for by a destruction term, yeah?
And yes, so I am fudging, this is my simplest one equation model. We will deal with errors in replication properly later on, but I could argue that if I wanted to. If phi is the concentration of the replicators, then anything which is not a replicator is not in that equation, right? So I could say that these are the rate of correct replications. Errors in replication is important, and we're going to come to that.
Just to see if I understand, if you had an unfolding step, right? So once folded, something could then be unfolded and then be the template again.
Yes.
That would be, because without that, it's an additive thing. Once you allow that, it becomes multiplication. Is that right?
The folding of the strand is important, and some people have built it into other models.
Yeah. I'm talking about the unfolding, because once it's folded, then it could unfold again, and then you get more template.
Yes. So really, a strand has to be able to do some folding and unfolding, because it has to be a catalyst, and it also has to be a template sometimes.
Right, but...
Or at least some fraction of them have to fold, and some fraction have to be templates. That would do it as well, right? There has to be some partitioning of...
But if you're allowing for unfolding, then all of a sudden your S variable becomes much easier to get, you know, increases much higher, because you're not having to depend on spontaneous formation. You can feed back in, and it becomes exponential, right?
I don't think so. Because
I trust you.
What would the folding do? The folding would remove some of that's not in the model, right? If I put some fraction that's folding in, it's going to reduce this term, because this is going to be a phi folded times a phi unfolded or something. And that, I don't think that's related to the S. The S is formation of new stuff.
Okay.
Anyway. This is the simplest, so the point of this equation is we can find the phase diagram very easily from that equation. So this function is a cubic equation, and it has three roots. It has two stable roots here and an unstable root in the middle. So the low stable root is what I'm calling the dead state, and that's basically when phi is very low. So the only terms that matter when phi are low are the S and the minus phi here. So it's basically saying the concentration in the low state is phi equals S, right? And then in the high state, that's when phi is high, all these terms are high, so it's pushed up against the limit here, so it's close to one. So the other root is close to one. So that's the living state.
Okay.
And the unstable route is in between. So what we have to do is we have to start down here, somehow manage to get across this unstable state. Once we've gone across the unstable, then we move up to the other stable high one, right? So that's some kind of a stochastic transition, which starts us off fluctuating down here. We wait for a million years, and we somehow, by a rare event, jump over there, and then we zoom up to the living state, right? And we did simulations of finite numbers of molecules reacting with one another and asking how likely it is to go across the unstable point. And, well, you can make that work. You can make that work in a computer. But what we realized is that in a large, if your test tube is the size of the Earth, and if things are well mixed, then fluctuations are very, very small. So basically, if you're in a well-mixed Earth-sized reaction.
Why did you need to do simulations? Why can't you just use a finite Markov chain? It's a tridiagonal.
Well, I'm not quite sure. Well, tell me how we should do. We'll have that. We'll have the math discussion later.
If you have a finite Markov chain and it goes either up one or down one, that's the expectation of the sojourn time is analytically tractable.
Okay, so if you have a way of solving this analytically, it would be interesting. So maybe for the simplest version, we can do that. But what I'm going to conclude from this is that if we have a very large Earth-sized reaction vessel, the number of molecules is very large, right? The number of simple molecules are very large. So you never get the concentration fluctuations that you need. And what we need is a way to make those concentration fluctuations happen. Okay, I'm jumping, aren't I? The point of that is that this phase diagram is the same as before, right? So let's just before we talk about the transition, we've got our cubic equation. I've drawn it with three roots. That's when the living and the dead exist. If I make my k very high, then this dip goes above the line here, right? And the only state is the high state, right? If I make my k and r too low, then the bump goes below the line, and then the only state is the dead state, right? So now as a function of my sr and k, I can work out my phase diagram. So in this case, I'm calling the chemistry axis is S, the spontaneous formation, and the biology axis is K, how good does the catalyst happen? And we have the same shape as before, okay? In a much more obvious way. Right, so now what I was going to say is, we're here, we're in this region of space of the parameter diagram where the living state exists, but we're in the dead state now. And we're in that, if we have an infinite deterministic reaction system, we're going to stay in the dead state forever because the dead state is stable. There's no way of getting across there. So what we need is a spatial model. So that's really where I'm heading for the rest of the talk now, is we need models with spatial positions of molecules and interactions between neighbors on the lattice, in my case, between close neighbors. In an infinite well-mixed system, the dead state is stable forever. So we need stochastic fluctuations in concentrations and numbers of molecules in order to jump from the dead to the living state. And replicating systems are extremely rare, so small numbers are important, right? There's large numbers of molecules, so we can deal with concentrations of monomers, of simple molecules, but we have to think about individual strands for the long strands, because when we start, there's only a handful of them, right? So stochastic fluctuations in those rare things that matter are going to be important. So what we need to do is to create a small patch of cooperating sequences in one place. And once we've managed to do that in one place, they interact with one another, they become stable, and then that thing spreads over the surface. So that's what I was showing you in the simulations at the beginning.
Question in the previous slide, why do you need a condition that state is stable forever?
I'm just saying it is stable forever if the phase diagram is the way I've drawn it there. So you can see in the cubic equation it's clear
that if that line goes down, if I'm higher than that point, the reaction, the growth rate is negative, so I shrink back to there, right? If I'm below, the growth rate is positive. So the things are taking me towards that point. And if it's deterministic, then I just stick at that point, right? And if I have finite numbers of molecules, I can get some fluctuations about there. And what I need is a way of making those fluctuations big enough to get me past this point, right? So, okay. So let's talk about a spatial model. So I'm going to have a lattice.
Just to go back just a second. So this is sort of assuming there's a very well-mixed system. Right?
In the,
I guess we're sort of moving towards that.
What we're saying is the well-mixed system doesn't work for lots of reasons, in fact. And one reason is that large well-mixed systems have very small fluctuations and you can't jump from the dead state. And another reason is well-mixed systems are unstable to cheats and parasites and things. So I'm going to argue that a spatial model gives you, firstly, the fluctuations that create the living thing, and it gives you the stability against parasites, which is where I'm going now. So,
I guess what I mean, there's no real diffusion barrier or anything in the system that you're starting with, I guess, right? You're just saying, even if you've got lots of guys eating up the resources, it's just this feed.
Yeah, and
there was no X or space.
Yeah. So far there was no space, and I was assuming everything was mixed, so there was just a concentration. And really what I'm saying is that that's not going to do it for you. Now we need spatial concentrations. So in my lattice model then, a site can be empty or occupied by one of three kinds of strands. So a red site is a polymerase. An orange site is a complementary strand to a polymerase. So when I copy a red, I make an orange, and when I copy an orange, I make a red. So only the red is the polymerase, but I need the oranges to be there as well in order to make the reds, okay? And then the gray is any old strand which is not one of the above. So a gray one could be a random strand made by the S reaction, or it could be an inaccurate copy of the reds or the orange. So this is where we're going to put in error rates, right? So I can make a non-functional gray strand by inaccurately copying a red or an orange. So, and I have the three reactions as before. So my S reaction creates random strands. The R reaction copies the strands. So the R reaction is the template-directed thing. If I have a strand, there's a probability of putting the complementary strand next to it. And then the K reaction is only performed by the polymerases, and the polymerases replicate strands on the neighboring sites. So if I have a template, and if it has a polymerase next to it, then the polymerase can replicate the template, and the copy of the template, the complementary sequence to the template, goes onto another vacancy next to the template.
So all mutations here are lethal, essentially.
All mutations are towards non-functional sequences. So they're not necessarily lethal, but they're destroying the function. And mutation, that's right. So I'm not allowed to mutate back from here to here.
So there's no ratchet weight.
They have zero ability, yes. So one mutation prevents the function altogether.
In other words, you don't keep track of polymerases that are suboptimally functional.
Yeah. You could do that. You could make a ratchet of decreasing polymerization ability if you wanted to, yeah.
So I think that's going to make it harder to establish things, because you'll just have this gradual decay, whereas this is very effective because the mutant is lethal. It's gone. It has no impact.
But it's not gone because it's a parasite.
There is a load.
So the point about the mutation is they are still there, and they are equally good at being templates. So this is the assumption. The assumption is that all the strands are equally good at being templates, but there's only one kind of functional thing. So a mutation creates me a template, which is a parasite, because it can be copied by the polymerase. So that's an interesting thing about what would happen if I had polymerases of decreasing and I don't really know what would happen.
So what about the concentration of subunits? I mean, it looks like that should be depleted in the vicinity of the cluster.
So I have a concentration of monomers, right? So there's a monomer concentration, and all the rates are proportional to the monomer concentration. And to begin with, I'm going to assume that monomers diffuse fast. So to begin with, I'm going to assume that the monomer concentration is the same everywhere. And then I'm going to show you that that doesn't get us very far, and we need to consider monomer diffusion. But that's several slides ahead. So for this thing, I'm assuming that there is monomer. So basically, I'm assuming that on each little lattice site, there's some concentration of monomers, which is a continuous variable. And then there's either one strand or not a strand. So I deal with strands as individual stochastic things, and I deal with monomer concentration as continuous variable.
At this point, continuous and constant, right?
Yes. So monomers are used up by the polymerization, and they are created again when the thing breaks down. So there's a death rate which recreates the monomers again. Monomers are created by chemistry, and they're destroyed by chemistry as well. So if there was no life there, if there was no strands, there'd just be a balance in concentration of monomers created by the chemical formation rate and the chemical breakdown rate. And the formation and breakdown of the strands uses up those monomers and then gives them back again. So this is the simulation I was showing you, and I think I'll just show you again at this point. So, okay, so the gray ones are the random strands. They're being created at a slow rate, the S rate. And I want to consider the limit where the probability of producing a functional red one is negligibly small. So what the model does is it says, if there are no red or orange ones in the system at the moment, then add one. And if there's at least one already, then it doesn't add any more. So here's a red one, right? It doesn't last very long. When there's nothing there, my next step adds one red one, which is another million years later until the next one comes along, right? So there are two rare events that have to happen to create the life in this thing. One is we have to create the mutation that makes the functional sequence, and then we have to get the spread of the functional sequence. So what's going to happen eventually is one of these red ones lasts for long enough to manage to make an orange one next to it, and then we get a little cluster of red and orange ones growing. And the time it takes to do that is, I don't know how long it's going to take. You know, have you got a million years now? I can change my parameters and adjust how long it takes to happen. But I want to show you, I want to make you wait a bit because it's more fun then, right? I mean, the point that I'm making is life is a rare event, but you have to wait for a long time for it to happen. But when it does happen, it spreads fast. Now,
are these things diffusing?
Yes. So there's a hot. So what are my parameters here? There's a rate. There's a rate for the S reaction, the R reaction, and the K reaction. There's a mutation probability, which is how likely is it that a replication of a red one makes a gray one. Okay. There's a hop rate, which is the diffusion of a molecule to the neighboring site. And well, that's about all.
So the mathematics might be similar to sort of the valley crossing problem in population genetics, where you're waiting for multiple rare events.
Yes, I think it's a bit like the fixation of a beneficial mutation in population genetics. So if you think, how likely is it to get a new beneficial mutation spreading? It's like, the first thing you have to do is make the mutation occur once, and then the second thing is that mutation has to become an appreciable fraction. So when you've made one good sequence, it has a large probability of dying.
I think it's like producing the combination of at least two beneficial mutations, not like the fixation of one. But luckily that's a problem that's also been solved.
Yeah. I know what you're saying, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's not like one beneficial mutation.
it's like in the set. Well, what I was saying it's like that is the fact that with one beneficial mutation, it has a large probability of dying out in the early stages. So it happened, right? So it was worth waiting for. Now the point is, once it's happening, it spreads very rapidly.
How fast is fast?
Well, it must be on the scale of the lifetime of the molecule, right? So my scale of one was the lifetime of a molecule. So how long does a molecule last on the primitive Earth? A day or hours or something, right? It doesn't last millions of years, right? The search process can take millions of years, but the lifetime of a molecule is some fairly small amount of time. So it means that the replication rate has to be comparable to that, okay? So that's why the spread is fast compared to the waiting time. Right. So, you know, there it is now crawling up your coffee cup. Once it's there, it goes everywhere, right?
Why is the concentration of gray higher in the life region? Is that
because it's being made by... Right, so there's two ways of making grays. They're appearing spontaneously out here with a low concentration, and they're being made here by the life by errors. Right?
So that's the mutation rate.
So
Paul, it seemed like there were, once that big one happened, we had another sort of colony down there and another colony over there. Is that just...
That's because it's going around the...
It's gone around. Yeah, okay.
So, so I have it set so that once... chemistry estimate the first red one. Right. But after that, I don't add any more red ones by chemistry. So all of these have descended from one red one.
Right. Excellent.
Right.
So... Maybe this is naive, but so I think that fusion and actually diffusion in the solution is incredibly fast. So any molecule doesn't sort of slowly go, it can whiz around and sample the whole thing in milliseconds.
Diffusion has to be slow for this to work. This is one of the conclusions. And so that's why I'm thinking about things. I have to have some spatial clustering. So I have to have slow diffusion, which would be, if they were bound to a surface and moving very slowly along the surface, that would give it to you. Maybe it would give it to you with those pores in the rock, so there was that picture with the pores in the rock, and they'd be trapped in a little pore and occasionally move to the next vacancy. That might give it to you. Or clustering caused by encapsulation in lipids might give it to you too.
Once you start clustering, you need to slow down.
But the big point is,
I'd say if you need two things to find each other, it may not take millions of years because diffusion is actually fairly efficient.
I mean, it wouldn't if they were confined to a cell or something. Right. If there's no confinement, I think that slows down the...
Right. What I think is important is if I just have a lake and fast three-dimensional diffusion in a lake, it's never going to work. I have to have some reason why I got one good one here, and it made a copy next to itself, and they have to stay together in order for this thing to expand, right? So they have. So this thing was spreading because basically it was forming things around its periphery, right? It was growing outwards. Okay, I'm going to show you in a minute that I can kill it by turning on fast diffusion.
Okay.
I want to show you something else first, right?
Paul, just a technical question. There used to be problems with the cellular automata models involving the updating procedure and in which you get artifacts of clustering of cooperators. And if you updated in one way, I can't quite remember, I think sequentially versus parallel.
Yeah, so you update in a random order. So there's a DT time step on here, right? And each time step, you visit each site once in a random order, and then the next time step you visit them in a different random order. So in each time step, each site has a probability of basically being replicated and a probability of dying. I visit each site once. Then there's a probability of motion, there's a probability of a thing hopping to a vacancy that's next to it.
That's randomized.
What would be the possibility of multiple foci given multiple little rocks and niches
right.
of confinement?
In the model, I've excluded that. In the real world, that's interesting. But I think the answer is that the spread is faster than the origin in the first place. So how long does it take life to spread across a planet? Don't know. But my nose tells me that's faster than the time you have to wait for it to arrive in the first place. So that suggests that there's one origin. But
That makes sense. Yeah,
right.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, what I've been trying to do, if you'll let me turn off, I want to prove that this is a lie. I want to turn off the S and the R, right? So now I have the S and the R were necessary. Those were the chemical parameters to create the thing in the first place. But now they're irrelevant, right? So not much. I turned the S and the R down to zero, and nothing much happens, because once I have a high concentration, the whole thing is being governed by the catalyst, right? Okay. Next thing I want to say is that this is with diffusion.
But so, Paul, do you get patches of necrosis here? Is that what we're seeing? With
you mean the white patches?
Yes.
So what we're seeing is occasionally we get a region where lots of parasites accumulate,
yeah,
and things die. But on average, there's stability, right? So this is stable, but we're seeing clustering here, right? And in fact, let's make the mutation rate higher, because that makes that. I'll do that next. Okay, I've just made the mutation rate a lot higher. And I don't know if that's too much. That'd be too ambitious. I don't want to kill it. What I want to say is that when the mutation rate goes up, we're going to get more patchiness. Okay?
Why do you call it a parasite? You're saying that the gray ones are parasites?
They're parasites in the sense that...
The gray ones?
Yes.
Okay.
In the sense that they can be copied by the red ones, but they do nothing.
I see.
Right?
But this is an odd sort of parasite, and then you're producing your own parasites.
Yes. So parasites are not... Okay, I just don't want to kill this yet. So let me just move this.
It's a non-replicating parasite.
What I want to say is that any sequence that is a template is intrinsically a parasite of the polymerase. Okay? So therefore, the polymerase is vulnerable to parasites, and we have to answer that question. And the conclusion is that spatial clustering saves you against parasites, okay? Right, so I'm going to say that's going to stay stable in this patchiness for a long time, right? But if I do this button...
This is where I worry about the lack of minor mutations. Because that'll do two things. That'll give you patchiness itself. This has been shown before with Muller's ratchet on a spatial scale, but then your local patches are small, so it seems to me that this would really encourage extinction.
I never thought about that.
I think the perfect way to design a mutation spectrum is, from a population viability standpoint, would just to be to make all your mutations lethal. You don't want too many, of course, but they're gone after one generation.
But they're not gone. So I don't think it's the same.
Case,
because, right.
It's a little more complicated.
Right. No, I agree. There may be something interesting if I was to consider a spectrum of partially reduced functional ones. One thing I did consider is when can a better one come in, right? So there's been work where, imagine you've got one working and a new better one comes along. But that better one favors itself, but it favors the other ones too, right? So in a non-spatial model, a better polymerase is not selected for because it benefits everything else equally to benefiting itself. But in a spatial model, a better one is selected for because it forms a cluster of better ones next to itself. So it preferentially favors itself, right? So I thought about that problem as when can you get better? I guess I didn't think about...
The better one can make the second better one, because then you're getting pretty close.
Yeah, let's just suppose. Imagine there's one mutation that creates a better one, and then replication of the better one makes the same thing over and over. Let's make the mutation rare. But when can that better one be selected? And the answer is you can select it in a spatial thing and not in a non-spatial one. I want to kill it for you now. I want to kill it by turning on the well-mixed button. So now after every time step, I just move things to a random site. And what's going to happen is the parasites are going to invade. So there's no spatial structure anymore. The parasites are benefiting because they're created by mutation. And eventually that's going to die. Okay, yeah, I'm going to go back to the talk because we're running out of time. So you'll just have to believe me that that's going to die because the parasites are going to invade. Do you want to see it die or not? I don't know.
I've got a vacation coming up, so hold off for a while.
Okay, look, it's going down. Everything is going to die together now. That's going to go back to low concentration. So let's switch that off. This is just showing that the error threshold problem, there's concentration of the strands and the mutant ones as a function of the mutation rate. So there's an error threshold similar to other error threshold problems. This is just showing there's a maximum hopping rate. As we turn up the diffusion of the strands, we kill it off because the parasites invade. So then we get to where are we going next then? And I'm thinking about this in the context of major transitions. And one kind of major transition would be, how do we get from a single kind of molecule that replicates towards something like a metabolism? So I'm imagining an RNA-based organism where we need lots of different ribozymes. And one of those would be the polymerase catalyst that copies all the others. And all the others could do whatever useful function they wanted to. And the most obvious useful function is to make monomers, okay? But making a monomer may be a complicated process. You may need lots of different ribozymes to make a monomer, and there's different kinds of monomers and so on. So in principle, you're going to need lots of different ribozymes that are controlling metabolic functions, but you only need one kind of polymerase because we're supposing that that polymerase works with any sequence. So that is a bit like the analogy of germ soma and division of labor that we've been talking about in this program. And maybe it's slightly different because I'm imagining recruitment of new functions. The first thing did the polymerase function. I'm adding new functions on top of that. That would be like developing a multicellular organism with different specialized cell types rather than splitting the function of the first cell, maybe. So the question I want to ask now is, can we get different types of independent strands to coexist and cooperate on a surface model? And the answer will be yes, but it's kind of hard. I'll show you why it's hard in the next few minutes, right? And maybe we need more than that, right? Maybe this spatial thing is not going to do it for you in terms of increasing complexity, because there's two other things that are obviously going to help in some way. So we know the two things that life did do is it found cells, okay? So if I put things in cells, instead of just having independent molecules replicating on the surface, then there are several advantages and disadvantages. So one thing is you get a plus is you get group selection, which means that you can have selection at the level of the cell as well as at the level of the molecule, and selection at the higher level can overcome competition at the lower level. So that's the usual argument in major transitions, saying that we want to get things into a big scale unit so that the selection on the big scale unit favors the cooperation of the small scale units. So that's going to help us. Keeping diffusion products within a cell is going to help us. So for example, if we're making monomers, we want those monomers to be used by our cell. We don't want them going off into the yonder, right? So keeping the products of our ribozymes, the metabolic small molecules, in where we want them is going to be good. On the other hand, we might need to make lipids. We might at least hope that lipids were there to begin with, but sooner or later we're going to run out of them and have to make more of them. And we need to transport things across membranes, so we need to get rid of waste products and import the things that we need. And we need to control cell division as well. So having cells brings in extra problems as well as getting rid of them, and that's why I started off with a model that didn't have cells. And then the other thing that happens in real life is we get chromosomes with linked genes. And putting genes on a linked thing helps, again, with the cooperation problem because they get replicated together. It also helps to put them in the same place, right? If I have two molecules of different functions and they're linked, then they have to be in the same place, which is obviously good. But then the error threshold problem gets worse because it's a longer sequence we need to copy. And also something that's interesting is if we have a strand with different genes on, it's like a genome, and we need to distinguish between replication and transcription. So replication would mean I'm going to copy the whole sequence and make a new genome, and transcription is I'm going to copy one gene and make one functional ribosome. Okay. So
seems like the error threshold would work both ways, because it would be, you're more likely to destroy a long strand. On the other hand, you're more likely to invent that other ribosome that you need.
Okay. I have one teaser slide at the very end about the linkage to show that, but I haven't done very much. What I have done for 5 minutes is looked at the question of cooperation of independent ribozymes with different functions. So I'm supposing that the two most important ribozymes are going to be a polymerase that catalyzes RNA replication and a nucleotide synthetase that catalyzes the synthesis of nucleotides. And obviously, in principle, they help one another. The question is, do they help one another in practice? So, if the synthase replicates too slowly, it dies out. If the synthase replicates too rapidly, it behaves like a parasite that kills the polymerase. Okay? So we have to find the right conditions when the two will work together. So here's a model of that. I have empty sites, polymerases, complementary strands, and mutants, same as before. And now I have blue ones that are going to be synthases, light blue ones that are complementary to those, and black ones that are mutant versions of the synthases. And I want to build up to that, right? So let's just build up. Let's do it without mutants first. I'll do it without mutants, and I'll do it with the blue ones are going to be non-functional. I've just called them short strands. What I want them to be, I want them eventually to produce monomers. But I want to show that even if they don't do anything, it's possible to get coexistence of these two things. So if I can get them to survive when these don't do anything, then it should work when they do something, right? So let's just do it in the case where the blue ones are independent short strands, and they have a different length. So now, important now is the length of the strand which is doing something. And I'm going to suppose that the replication rate, there's some intrinsic polymerization rate. This is how fast do I add one monomer. This is the concentration of monomers, and this is the length. So, and I'm looking at the case where this length is half of this one, so it means that the short ones replicate twice as fast as the long ones. Okay, so shorter is better, right? So, well, so this is what happens, right? So this is what happens in that model. I can get coexistence of two things. The red ones are helping themselves. The blue ones are parasites, really, because they're not doing anything. The blue ones kind of cluster around the edges of the red things, but everything's okay. There's a coexistence in that case.
So the blue ones, this is just sort of a mixed set of genotypes, is that?
They're just random polymers? The blue ones are any short strands at the moment. In a minute, I'm going to make some functions.
There's lots of types of blues. They don't all have the same sequence.
Well, okay. I want them to be one specific strand which is a functional polymerase. That's really where I'm going. But at this point, it doesn't matter because all I'm saying is that the replication rate depends on the length. So it doesn't matter whether there's one type or any sequence. Okay. So the point is, even though these blue ones multiply twice as fast, they're still stable in coexistence with the red ones because of the clustering, right? And it's because the blue ones depend on being next to the red ones. The blue ones can only be copied when they're next to the red ones.
So in Mike's case, if you had multiple copies of that, then you would have other colors, green and purple and so forth.
Well, I'd go back to my mutant case. That's right. If I turn on mutation,
why wouldn't you get islands? Red things surrounded by green, or red things surrounded by purple, or red things surrounded by...
Right. If they're non-functional sequences, I might as well give them all the same color because they behave the same way in the model, right?
So all the green ones are equally good.
Right. That's right.
The black ones are toast.
Yes.
I guess the point is that the blue ones aren't special sequences. Right? They don't have any remarkable capabilities.
But now,
there are multiple shades of blue, but we're not worried about it.
I want to make them, I'm moving towards the point when the blue ones are special sequences. That's really the point. But I want to solve the first problem is when can you get coexistence of two strands of different lengths? That's the point, right? And I gave you an example where it works. But if I make the blue ones longer than 90, So that's still shorter than the red ones. Red ones are 100 in this, right? This is still shorter, but they die because the blue ones are dependent on the red ones. So what happens is this thing dies if I make the blue ones too long. It also dies if I make the blue ones too short, because now the blue ones multiply too fast and they kill off the red ones and then everything dies. Okay? So there's a range of stability in which there's coexistence between the blues and the reds. The coexistence is between these two lines here. Okay?
So isn't that equivalent to what Mike was saying, that if you have polymerases of different functionality, then you can die off if you don't get it exactly right? Because this would be a polymerase that is non-processive. It makes a 30 instead of 100.
No, that's not the same question. My blue ones here are independent, right? So the difference between this bit and the bit before was before I was considering mutations of the polymerase, which were the same length as the polymerase. So those the gray ones, the mutants before, were being created by inaccurate replication. So they were the same length, that was the assumption. Here, I'm considering something which is independent of the red ones. So the blue ones are not made by copying the red ones. The blue ones exist, right? And I'm asking whether independent blue ones can coexist with the red ones. Okay?
But there is still this issue of being able to survive the fact that blue ones are a kind of mutation that appear.
You have to get to link 50 somehow. Like starting
exactly. I mean, you'd imagine a processive thing where you get, you know, an exponential distribution where at each length, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there's a certain probability of abortive polymerization. And so, you know, the mutants that you've got to protect yourself against are the entire length spectrum for some fidelity rate.
So what we are looking at that we didn't do yet is a version of the first model where you make a non-functional mutant which is initially the same length as the red one, and then deletions occur and it gets shorter and shorter, right? So you probably know about the Q-beta replicase experiments, right? Where you start with the Q-beta virus, which is 4,000 long, and it goes shorter and shorter. It goes to something which is very rapidly multiplied by the polymerase. Because in that experiment, you're giving the polymerase there in the experiment. So the virus doesn't need to encode the polymerase anymore. So it just gets shorter and shorter, and it becomes a fast multiplying template with no coding. So I think that's the problem that you're talking about. So if...
I'm just talking about the risk of invasion by...
By shorter and shorter templates.
Yeah, that those are the mutants it appears that you need to worry about more than the non-functional one.
Fitness is proportional to one over length.
Yes. And so the answer is it depends how short they are. If there's going to be a fast rate of production of very short ones, you're going to die.
I'm saying that they will. The production rate will presumably fit an exponential in terms of the fidelity. Polymerase will break at some rate as it processes.
Okay. That's an interesting way of thinking about it. The way I am thinking about it now, which we didn't really finish yet, is some probability of deletion. Let's say I start with 100 and I have a probability of deleting between 1 and 10, and it goes, you know, to 90, to 80, 70. So I'm considering the case with a gradual reduction in size due to missing out of small bits, which is the way I was imagining errors in sequence replication, I guess.
Yeah,
I guess your point also is interesting, that you could stop halfway at some random point.
Yeah, I mean, the question is whether you've got an adult, if you want to call it that, that breaks, or whether the problem is that these are just very low fidelity processes, and at which point, you know, it's the question is how did you get to full length? I mean, to get to 100 requires a pretty high level of fidelity at each precession.
Yeah.
And you don't have any kinetic proofreading or anything that's evolved yet, so they're not going to be very high fidelity, and there's going to be a length, you know, what will happen ultimately is you'll get a length limit in how long anything could be, because what I just learned is that one of the reasons is parasitism by shorter fragments.
So
you may find you can't get anything of length 100 under any realistic regime, that you need to be length 30 or whatever, if you're going to think of a single ribosome being a polymerase with no kinetic proofreading.
Well, we don't know how long the thing has to be functional, and we don't really know what the error rate was. So there's the usual rule that the longer it is, the higher its accuracy has to be. Yeah. So that still applies. So all the stuff about the error threshold is still applying in this case. Okay, so we've proved that you can get coexistence of independent kinds of replicators, provided that the lengths are appropriate, right? Providing that the dependent one, the blue one, is not too long or too short. So now I want to make the blue ones do something. So now I want to consider blue ones are producing monomers. So we're going to have some diffusion equation for the concentration of monomers, which is actually dependent on what site I'm on. So I have an A, which is a production rate by chemistry. So this is the rate at which chemistry gives me monomers. This is the rate at which the synthase gives me. So there's some B times the concentration of synthase, which is production of monomers by the synthase. There's a breakdown rate. This is the destruction rate of the monomers by chemical processes. And if there were nothing else going on, if everything else was constant, in other words, if everything was well mixed and not time dependent, then what I would have is big A is equal to little a plus bx. Okay? So it would say that the average concentration in a stationary state would be equal to the amount given me by the chemistry plus the amount given me by the synthesis. Right? But we're going to need to put in diffusion, and we're going to need to take proper account of minus polymerization means that monomers are used up by the polymerization, and plus breakdown means that when the thing breaks down, it gives me the monomers back on that side. Okay? And sorry, I'm running out of time. So this is just to say that it works. So this is the survival of the reds and the blues together, and I've got it in a case where my A is naught. So the point is I've turned off my A now. In the previous example, when the blues were non-functional, the chemistry has to give me the monomers, right? But now I've got it to a state where the chemistry is not giving me monomers anymore. The blue ones are making the monomers. The blue ones are diffusing outwards from there. And the thing is stable, okay? And to get that to work, I need to deal with proper diffusion of monomers. This is the point. So the blue ones are producing monomers on their own site. They're gradually diffusing out. So the reds need to be next to the blues in order to get the monomers, and the blues need to be next to the reds in order to be replicated, right? So that's cooperation in two ways. And that's stable against mutation, black ones are mutation. I will zoom through there. So what have we said? To get these things to cooperate, strand diffusion must be slow enough to allow joint clusters to form. So that's what I call hopping, the motion of the strands. Synthases must replicate sufficiently fast, otherwise they die out. Synthases must not replicate too fast, otherwise they are polymerases. Monomer diffusion must be fast enough to benefit the polymerases. They have to get from the red to the blue, from the blue to the reds, right? And monomer diffusion must not be too fast, otherwise synthases are overrun by their own mutants. So I didn't show, that was the bit I zoomed over. If the monomers do rapidly, the concentration of monomers is equal everywhere, and those monomers are a public good. So what happens then is you get invasion by the mutant synthases. So the blue ones are not stable to mutation if the monomers are equal to concentration everywhere. So that's kind of, it works, but there's a lot of conditions. So I'm starting to worry now about whether this vision of a metabolism with many independent kind of ribozymes on a surface would work. And I'm beginning to think that that won't work very well, and we need some of those extra factors fairly soon. So extra factors would be cells and chromosomes. And then I promised you a teaser. So this, oops, yeah, that's my last slide. That's my teaser showing evolution of linkage. So the reds and blues are independent ribozymes, same as before, and the yellow is a linked strand of the two ribozymes on the same strand. And the point is the yellow is self-sufficient. The yellow has everything it needs. The blues and reds need to go together. But the yellow is a lot longer, so it replicates more slowly. So this is, but But nevertheless, the yellow cluster is invading the other ones in this case. So the link, so that's a selection for linkage. And so selection for linkage was looked at by Maynard Smith and Zathmari a long time ago in a protocell model. And I've been trying to find examples of where people have shown it works in a, on a surface model, and I've not found that. So as far as I know, this is the first demonstration that linkage is favored in a surface slow diffusion model. So that's the end. Sorry, I'm at the end. Sorry, I'm running out of time.
Wonderful.